Sorry, couldn't get the board is not cooperating. Every time I'm on the show by myself, I run into a technical glitch at the beginning, so this will be my trademark. This is Mike Vandervoort, Drive Through HR with an extended music play. It's March 5th, and our guest today is Casey Sipe. He's an employment lawyer, and he got a really dramatic entry music. It's probably not the music he would pick if he were going to the mound, I would imagine. Casey, how you doing today?
I'm doing great here in snowy central Pennsylvania.
Daily update on the weather report: snowy in Pennsylvania, very rainy, and about 35 in the mountains in Georgia. I was in Florida yesterday, and it was 82, so much nicer there. Yeah, those of us who don't live there at all or anymore are insane for not being there. So anyway, Casey, let's not talk weather. Let's talk employment law. Glad to have you on as a guest. Why don't you go ahead and give us a quick introduction to who you are, where you come from, your background, that kind of stuff, and then we'll get into some discussion about NLRB and the law.
Sure. As you said, my name is Casey Sipe. I'm an attorney with Scaringi & Scaringi. We're a law firm located in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. My practice concentrates primarily in employment law. I do some other things as well, but it's mostly employment law. I've got some background working for both private law firms and actually the Pennsylvania state government doing employment law work. There's a lot of things that I've seen. I've gotten a lot of great experience and been able to help a lot of people.
Were you in the public sector before you, because you're with private practice now, so you must have done the other the other stuff first, right? What did you do there? What was your role there?
It was mostly defending. I worked for the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry, so I defended the department in a lot of employment law issues. Issues before the EEOC and things like that. They're one of the larger departments in Pennsylvania government, so there were a lot of issues that tended to come up.
So you were like an in-house counsel and represented them as you would a private client, only they were just in their role as a government agency if somebody brought a complaint or an employment action against them.
Exactly.
Cool. Yes. And now in private. So how long have you been a lawyer? You've been in out for how long from law school?
About 7 years now.
Okay, cool. So there's a lot going on I think people, that probably listen to Drive Through probably are like, oh, it's Mike, it's going to be another boring labor show. But the truth is there's a lot of stuff going on in labor law right now, and not only with the NLRB, but that's kind of what we're going to focus on today. So what are you guys at your law firm, what are you hearing from your clients, and what's keeping your clients awake at night in Pennsylvania, Casey? Let's start with that.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of things actually going on with the NLRB. I think if people have been paying any sort of attention to what's been going on, this iteration of the NLRB is, I think, calling them activists would actually be underselling it. They've been doing a lot of things that have been causing employers a significant amount of headache. The big thing that seems to be hitting the news right now are the quickie elections rule, as it's called. That goes into effect April 14th at the moment. It's actually sort of popped back into the news because the Republican-controlled Congress is trying to essentially have it overturned. They can try to pass a resolution, and if they're successful, then it goes before the president, and that's sort of where the problem comes in because, it passed the Senate, I think, the other day, and it's going to go to the House where it will probably also pass, but President Obama has basically said that he'll veto it if it comes across his desk, and I don't think that Congress has the 60% majority that they need to get, the two-thirds majority that they need to get in order to overturn his veto. So, unfortunately, I think that the quickie election rule is probably here to stay.
Yeah, there's a couple of groups. Well, there's a number of groups that have filed a number of other kind of actions, class action to seek injunction on it as well. I know SHRM and the U.S. Chamber have different. They may have joined on the same claim, but there's several different things that I think the business community is trying to do to help at least delay, if not stop, the implementation of the quickie election rules. Can you kind of tell, for those, there's a lot of folks who won't know what quickie elections is. That's not really what the NLRB calls it. They're calling it a final rule to streamline the election process. Can you tell us quickly what that change will do, and then I'll comment on it for a second. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So they're not calling it the quickie election rule. Streamlines a term that they're trying to push through. But basically, it will help speed up the election process for unions. So it allows union election petitions to be transmitted electronically. It requires that a pre-election hearing be held within 7 days after the filing of the petition, which it used to be 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it also postpones an employer's ability to challenge the eligibility of voters. So typically one of the things that you could do, especially if you thought it was going to be a close vote, is that you could challenge an employee's eligibility to vote based on the fact that they might be a supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
or something similar. So those are the big things that the rule will put into effect.
So what that means is from a practitioner point of view, if you got a union election, if you got employees signing cards and they filed with the NLRB to conduct an election to determine whether or not they wanted to be represented by a union, in the past, the average time for an election from time of filing until the election being held on your property was about 38 to 42 days. The NLRB streamlining will reduce that down to somewhere between 14 and 21 days. That's one big change. Another thing is it requires that employers provide any personal email and any phone contact and home addresses that they have available for the employees as part of the disclosure to the NLRB, which that means that personal information for your employees will be going to the union, which will make it a lot easier for the union to do home visits and reach out to those employees. And the third thing it does is it requires that any issues that you want to raise in terms of issues regarding the unit or the employees, or whether or not they're eligible, those all have to be done in a brief that has to be filed like 1 week from the time that the election is filed. And if you fail to raise any issues, then those are out. So it's streamlining, and what's interesting is unions already, if they get an election, unions already win something like 65% of the elections that they file for. And I saw some data the other day from a group called the Labor Relations Institute, which is LRIonline.com, and they showed that if the board has run some of these quickie elections in the past. Not all elections are 38 days automatically; some are shorter. So in the last 10 years, of all the shorter cycle elections that they ran, unions win an additional 30% of those elections. So that this is a huge advantage to the unions if they can get this change pushed through, and as you said, it looks like it's going to go. So potentially have a big impact on the chances of employers winning an election, but also takes away a lot of the defense that you guys as lawyers could use, and makes the case prep a lot more difficult and expensive, I think, as well, doesn't it?
I agree, and it really puts, you know, the employer it sets them back in a lot of ways. And in my experience, most employers are not prepared for union organizing to begin with. So even under the old rules, if you didn't have a plan in place, it was difficult to mobilize everything quickly in order to combat, you know, the union. But now, I mean, if you don't have a set plan in place, if you're not training your supervisors and everyone already, then you're already behind. Because
yeah, it's not going to be good enough to just have you on speed dial, right? Or any labor lawyer. I mean, there's going to be so much stuff that you have to do in such a short period of time that it's going to be almost impossible to even be in compliance, from what I can see.
Right. When I worked at another law firm before my current firm, and we had a very, very large client, one of the largest privately held companies in the country. And with them, we essentially set up a green light, yellow light, red light process where we trained all the supervisors all around the country and explained to them these are the green light situations. These are where you and this is who you need to contact if A, B, or C happens. And then these are the yellow light situations. These are more serious. If A, B, or C happens, then you need to call all the people in green and these people. And if it's a red light situation, which was, you know, union cards being signed, then,
yep.
you know, there were more people to contact. And so it was sort of an escalating process. But
so you
know,
had
at least it
kind
was
of
way,
like – sorry, I'm talking over you. Go ahead. I got a
oh, no,
question
it's fine.
I want to ask you.
I would say it was just a way it's a simplified way of explaining this to the supervisors. And, I mean, they're
yep.
really your first line of defense because they're the ones
– Absolutely.
They have their boots on the ground. They're around the employees. They're going to see things before, you know, the VP or the HR director or somebody like that sees them
mm-hmm.
just by virtue of spending, you know, 8 hours or 12 hours or whatever your workday is every single day with these line workers.
So was that like a literally a checklist kind of thing? Was it like literally something that was color-coded or was it just the way you presented training with the green light, red, yellow light, red light stuff? Do you
no,
remember?
We color-coded
So they had like a matrix or a card or something that said if you run into this sort of situation with these factors, this is what you should do. Is that literally how that kind of it translated?
I don't remember if we actually had a document that we gave them. That was just how
mm-hmm.
we put it in the that's how we put it in the training presentation.
Got
but it was
okay. Got
it was you know, we just figured that was a like I said, a pretty simple way to explain it and you know, everybody's familiar with stoplights, so
it's a really good way to do it. I mean, I can see how it would be a really good way to do it in that example. So that's a great idea. Thanks for sharing that. So
of course.
It's about 1:13, Casey. The show runs a half an hour, so I'm gonna deviate like 2 minutes. We're gonna do a quick reset since we had a little flaw at the beginning. This is Michael Vandervoort on Drive Through HR with Casey Sipe, attorney at law. We're talking employment practice, and Casey had just kind of walked us through a bit about the NLRB, which he described as activist, and that's a kind of a light way of saying it, and some of the changes that they're putting in place related to union election process. They're not only dealing with that kind of stuff, though, Casey. They're dealing with lots of other stuff, right? I mean, there's email access and there's social media and a bunch of other things. I wonder if you want to touch on one of those topics now.
Sure. Let's start with email access and then see if we can fit social media in at the end.
Sure.
So previously, since 2007, the NLRB said that employees could not use their employer's email system to in attempts to organize for union activity. But lo and behold, last year, I think it was December 11th, you can see that sort of burned in my mind. The NLRB actually overturned that in a case called Purple Communications. And it basically said that the prior ruling undervalued the employee's core Section 7 rights to communicate in the workplace about their terms and conditions of employment. So Section 7 basically says that an employer cannot take any action that would affect the employee's right to concerted protected activity, which is things like discussing job conditions, safety, wages, and things like that. And if we get a chance to talk about social media, we'll touch on that again
mm-hmm.
because that
mm-hmm.
that's important. So basically, after Purple Communications here, the employees are now able to send non-work emails related to union activity using the employer's email system, which seems somewhat counterintuitive, but the NLRB pointed out, I guess, that using the email system doesn't hurt any of the other employees. You know, the email systems are fairly robust, so even if you're sending out hundreds of emails, it's not going to slow down emails for everybody else. So it won't really affect how the rest of that's going to work. So,
right.
And it doesn't add any additional costs to the employer because, you know, we're not paying per email or anything like that. It's not as if the NLRB said, oh, well, employees can use, you know, the employer's postage meter to send things out. Because that would obviously add costs. But with email, no added costs, so they're saying that's okay.
So that essentially means that in the future, depending on how you have how you have email access set up for your employees, there might very well be a chance that employees could be sending emails within the company system to each other about a union organizing campaign, right? That's kind of the bottom line of that.
Right.
And not much you're going to be able to do to stop it other than maybe you know, enforce working time and that all that kind of stuff. So there's
exactly
it's going to be complicated. And I suspect there will be a lot of litigation that comes out of that as employers appeal those kind of things and argue over factual situations. Same thing, right, with social. I mean, social media. Before I jump to social, is there anything you can recommend that employers do right now? I mean, obviously there's probably some policy stuff they should set up, but what do you recommend to the clients if they're talking to you about email and email access?
Right. I mean, really, it is going to be about going through your policy. You know, it might be okay if you have a uniform policy that prohibits large attachments or audio video segments, because that could potentially slow down your system, your email system, and then affect other employees. So things like that might be possible. But it looks like the burden is probably going to be on the employer to show why any restrictions are being put into place. You're actually going to have to show, at least if the board decides to put you in their crosshairs, you're going to have to show why it's reasonable for you to have this rule into place. And it's not going to be enough to simply say, well, we're trying to prevent union organization. It's going to have to be some
sort
of
business. The law.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So then let's shift over to social media. And I know you're active on Twitter. And why don't you tell us where? We'll do that at the end of the show. You can tell us where people can find. You can tell folks where they can find you at the end of the show.
Okay.
You're active on Twitter, and that's actually how I got to know you. I think you may have Facebook and LinkedIn connections with me as well, but I have so many I lose track sometimes. So what are you seeing from a legal point of view on social media? I mean, the NLRB was very, very active about broadening the amount of latitude that employees had to engage in employment related issues on social media and the things they're allowed to say, and that's sort of become almost normative. Now that's been a couple years in the process, but it's still pretty complicated and it still can get kind of down and dirty, right?
Yes, it is extremely complicated right now, and at the risk of coming across as fear-mongering, I don't think it's a good idea for people to just sort of start hacking at their policies and trying to come up with a social media policy just because of all of the decisions that have come down from the NLRB. You know, it really is a very touchy situation because they're basically looking at these policies and interpreting them in the broadest way possible to find a violation of Section 7. So we said protected concerted activity, you know, you can't do anything to encumber that. So they're finding that policies that say you can't talk about confidential information on social media violate Section 7 because they're saying that employees may believe that wages and work conditions are prohibited. I'm sorry, and this is actually going out to even beyond social media, actually, to policies where I think it might have been last month or a couple months ago. There was a case where the employer's policy forbidding discussions of internal investigations could not be disclosed to outside people, and the NLRB hacked that down because they said it infringes on Section 7 rights. So they're really interpreting pretty much any policy in such a way that it will violate Section 7 rights. So it's like I said, it's very touchy right now. It's very difficult to craft these in a way that will pass muster. But at least at this point, we haven't had too much in the way of social media decisions from the NLRB. So things have settled down a little bit, and we don't have to worry about the law changing every other week like it seemed like it was there for a while.
It was for quite a while. They did release the general counsel for the NLRB, or the actually it's the former now, did release a kind of a long memo, an advice document around social media policies and what the NLRB thought was a good employer policy. And I guess that was maybe, I don't know, a year plus ago, and it was like mm-hmm. it was incredibly long, and you had to give like examples and stuff. I mean, it was do you see many clients going to that extreme that the examples that the board put out, or are you still seeing kind of a more traditional policy in terms of social media?
Almost without exception, every single policy that I've reviewed for social media would not pass what the NLRB is looking for. As you said, the NLRB wants examples. They want definitions. I mean, you could conceivably write a 20-page social media policy based on all of this NLRB guidance if you really, really wanted to play it safe. Now, of course, why would you ever want to do that? And nobody would ever read it. So you don't really want to go that route. So it's important to try and find that sort of middle ground where you're being clear, but you're also being concise, and that's where the challenge lies. But you know, it's like I said, they're looking even now beyond the social media to other policies. I actually wrote a blog post probably 6 or 8 months ago, maybe more, where I asked, you know, hypothetically, whether the NLRB was going to start looking at BYOD policies and try and find, you know, issues in there about, you know, what employees are allowed to do with the company network from their own devices. So, you know, this
right.
is...
Let's just, for the, there may be one or two people in the whole world that don't know what BYOD is. Bring your own device, right? Bring your own cell phone and have access to a company email and other kind of websites through your phone.
Right. So it's bring your own device instead policy. Instead of the employer providing a cell phone or a tablet or something like that, employees are now and it's a I don't even think you can call it a trend anymore. It seems to be the standard for the most part that employees are allowed to bring their own device. You know, connect into the company intranet or email or both, and you know, some people can even do their work from their tablet if they really needed to. So, you know, that could be a whole nother podcast.
maybe one of these days we'll do that one. So like, what kind of issues do you see there? I mean, beyond just the, you know, kind of like working time. I mean, I think one of the big things about it, if you have work on your own device, you're always tethered, right? I mean, you have to turn it off or ignore it, and a lot of people find that hard to do. And of course, hourly people aren't even supposed to be working unless you pay them, and all those
right.
kind of things. But what kind of specific issues do you see with bring your own device policies and amongst your cases?
I would say that the overtime issue is probably the biggest one that I see. So if you have employees that are hourly and they are working from home, maybe even just answering an email, they have to be paid for that. And there was actually a recent decision regarding the overtime laws that said that if the court could sort of impute knowledge to the employer that they could be held liable for overtime worked, even if it was prohibited. So for example, if you have a supervisor who's salaried, sending emails to an hourly worker and the hourly worker is responding to those emails, even if your policy says that they're not supposed to do that, this supervisor now has knowledge that this person is working more than 40 hours, likely, and so now the employer has basically constructive knowledge of this overtime worked, and so they have to be paid.
We had someone you know on a week or so ago. We had Kate Bischoff on, and she brought up this this device, like a badge that actually lets you track your workers. You know, you don't just use it to clock in and out. It actually reports the whereabouts of the workers as they move through a warehouse or an office or whatever. So it's like having an electronic tether on the employee, and you can literally, I guess, I haven't seen the technology specifically, you know, in live, but it apparently allows you to pretty much be this eye in the sky all the time. And phones do that already, but I think most employers don't use phones for that. So we're headed kind of into some really strange new areas. We've got about 3 minutes left, Casey, and I want to make sure you get your contact information out there. But before we wrap, what else? Got one other quick thing you want to share, or one other, you know, not a topic, but one other thing you want to nugget you want to leave us with about how employers can help with this stuff or whatever it might be?
I mean, I maybe just sort of reiterate something we already talked about, which is, you know, get a plan in place, be prepared to execute it, and train, because that is the best way to avoid union problems. And you know, if you train your supervisors, you know, that's the front line, that's the first step in preventing problems. So I think that's probably the biggest, you know, takeaway on the union side. And for non-union employers with these, with the way the NLRB is looking at these policies, you know, you just want to review your policies, take a really, really close look at them, preferably hire legal counsel to do it, somebody who's familiar with all this, make sure that they are familiar with all these new NLRB decisions and how they're affecting the workplace, because, you know, you don't want an amateur, you know, slogging away through your policies and basically paying to get yourself into trouble.
Yeah, so it's kind of like if you're in HR and you haven't done it, hire a lawyer and have them check your handbook and all your documents. We're down to about 70 seconds, Casey. So tell people where they can find you, your blog, your Twitter, all that stuff. And thanks for being on. It was a very interesting show. I appreciate you coming on as a guest. Let us know where you can be found.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. Like Mike said, I'm on Twitter pretty much constantly at CLS Employer Law. And you can also find my blog at employers-lawyer.com. It hasn't been updated in a little while, and I need to get back on that, and I will as soon as my son starts letting us sleep again at night. He's 2 months old, and we're hoping that he gets through the night a little bit more.
Congratulations. All right, well, listen, I really appreciate you coming on. This is Michael Vandervoort. We're wrapping up our March 5th episode of Drive Through HR with Casey Sipe, and I'm going to take us out with some ZZ Top. Casey, thanks for being on.
Thanks.
Theoretically, I'm taking us out with some ZZ Top.